Welcome, everyone. I'd like to call the House Higher Education Finance Policy Committee to order. I will note for the record that we are joined by the Democrats today. I am so happy that you're here. So we do have quorum. And we also have the Office of Higher Education here today. We are so excited to have them here to do a presentation. Before I get moving on to some member introductions, I want to just remind those in the audience that we have a few rules here at the House of Representatives, and the sergeants have asked me to read this into the record. So we don't allow signs, outbursts, or clapping in the committee. There's no standing or sitting in the walkways or the aisles. If you need a special accommodation, there are gentlemen at the doors, the sergeants are there that they can help you. If you do cause a disruption, you will be removed from the hearing. On to testifiers. We do have a bill up today, and each testifier will have 2 minutes. And this also is a ticketed event, and so we have already ticketed those that are in support or opposed to the bill that we will have later. So from there, I'd like to move on to member introductions. And since we have a full agenda today, if you would just state your name and your district. And I will start. I am Chair Marion Rarick, formerly O'Neill. Many, many people know me as O'Neill, and I got married in the past couple years to Senator Jason Rarick, and my district is 29B in Wright County. So I'm going to go right here to our lead.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dan Walgamott, representing the people of St. Cloud in District 14B. And Madam Chair, on behalf of the House Democrats on Higher Education, I want to express how grateful we are to be here with you today. And I know that you have a reputation of being a good bipartisan leader. I want members of the committee to know that Representative Rarick and I actually met for lunch in my district a couple months ago, and I know that we are eager to work with you and pass a bipartisan budget that meets the needs of our students and our institutions. So thank you very much for your leadership and your bipartisan partnership, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Lead Wolgamon. I appreciate it. We'll continue on. We'll go to member first, come back to staff.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Tina Liebling from Rochester. This is my first time on the Higher Ed Committee. Happy to be here.
Welcome. Yes. We're glad to have you here.
Hi, I'm State Representative Ginny Cleborne. I represent the cities of Plymouth and Medicine Lake in the northwestern suburbs. Excited to be back at Higher Ed.
Hi, I'm Representative Nathan Coulter. I am in my second tour of duty on Higher Ed and in the House. I serve District 51B, which is basically the eastern half of the city of Bloomington.
I'm Representative Jess Hansen. I represent District 55A at Savage in Northwest Burnsville in the Southwest Metro. I'm in my third term, and I've been on higher education the whole time. I'm a first-generation college graduate. I'm also a teen mom with a master's degree.
Hello, my name is Mahmoud Noor. I represent District 60B. That's in Minneapolis, the neighborhood surrounding the University of Minnesota.
Hi, I'm Representative Kim Hicks. I represent 25A, which is Rochester.
Thank you. And then over to our vice chair, and then we'll start with our vice chair, and then we'll start back with Representative Robbins.
Hello, everybody. My name is Erica Schwartz, and I represent Nicollet County 18A.
Hi, Representative Kristen Robbins, 37A, which is Western Hennepin County.
Hi, everybody. My name is Keith Allen. I represent 19A, which is an hour south of here, encompasses the communities of Wanamingo, Canyon, Faribault, and Janesville.
And you take over for my brother, Brian Daniels, who retired after 10 years.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Representative Peggy Scott, and I represent Northern Anoka County, District 31B.
Representative Bedell Duran, I represent 2A, and that's Beltrami, Clearwater, and Lake of the Woods County.
Paul Novotny, 30B, I represent Elk River, now then parts of Otsego and parts of Oak Grove.
Great, thank you. Let's circle back to staff, and we'll start right here.
Sean Herring, this is my third term on higher ed, and I am the DFLCA.
I'm James Cook, and I'm the committee legislative assistant with Representative Rarick.
I'm Lori Cousineau, and I'm the CA for higher education in the GOP caucus.
I'm Nathan Hopkins. I'm the nonpartisan legislative analyst from the House Research Department.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ken Savory. I'm the nonpartisan fiscal analyst covering this committee.
Great. And we have a few staff back here. If you would stand up and let everybody know who you are.
Yeah, Ben Fries, House Republican Research.
Okay. And then over here.
Jennifer Nelson, House DFL Research.
Great. And we have a couple pages here. If they would stand and let us know who you are.
Hi, I'm an homage committee patron. Griffin Larson, South High School.
Okay. I'm Lila Schwartz, and I go to Mankato West.
I'm Amelia Schultz, and I go to Hopkins High School.
I'm Zia Rocker, I go to Rochester Mayo.
I'm Danielle Lopez, and I go to St. Agnes High.
I'm Mercedes Seves, I go to Princeton High School.
Thank you all. So we actually have one committee page and a lot of other pages that are interested in this topic. So we have a room that is full. Thank you, one and all. Thank you for being here. And we are going to move straight into the Office of Higher Education. And welcome to the committee if you want to come up and start your overview. So welcome to the committee. We are so glad you're here. If you want to introduce yourself for the record and then continue with your testimony.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Dennis Olson. I serve as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education.
Hello, thank you for having us. For the record, my name is Wendy Robinson. I'm the Assistant Commissioner at the Office of Higher Education.
Oh, for the record, my name is Nikki Oliver. I'm the Director of Government Relations and Community Engagement for the Office of Higher Education.
Welcome. And I believe we have it in the, we have a packet from you, so everyone should have this at their desk. Okay. Commissioner Olson, are you going to start us out?
Yes. Thanks again, Madam Chair. Really appreciate it. And you referenced the packet. We're not going to talk about the content in there, but more for background as, and, you know, maybe if we do get to some of those specific programs, we'll be able to point you to that one pager or some of the related information, but mostly going to be delivering just oral testimony here and referencing some of the line items on the spreadsheet. I know the committee's been working through over the course of the past few weeks. So I'm just going to dive in if that's okay.
Of course. Thank you, Commissioner Olson. So we're going to be working through the larger spreadsheet. So that's in your packet. And since we are a finance committee and we're all about finance, we have very few bills that come through this committee. We're going to do a deep dive on the budget that flows through the Office of Higher Education. So with that, I'll turn it back to Commissioner Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, recognizing that we have quite a few new members here on the Higher Education Committee this year, I thought it would be beneficial to just do a brief overview of the office responsibilities, the agency responsibilities of the Office of Higher Education, just kind of set the table a little bit, and then, of course, you know, are prepared to walk through all of the budget line items, the programs we oversee and administer within the agency, as well as the other programs that we work with throughout the state. And so just wanted to, you know, first let the committee know of our primary responsibilities as an agency. And I know Mr. Hopkins had given an overview earlier, but primarily we oversee and administer state financial aid programs. That is our key primary function. Those, of course, include the state grant, the Minnesota State Grant Program, state work study and child care grants, the Minnesota Indian Scholarship Program, tuition reciprocity, and of course have a student loan program called the Minnesota Self Loan. We also, of course, administer competitive and legislatively named grants. We have an oversight and regulatory function as well, and so we register degree granting colleges and also license non-degree granting career schools within the state. We negotiate tuition reciprocity agreements with neighboring states, primarily North Dakota and Wisconsin, but also institutions in Manitoba in Canada, as well as in Iowa. Now, we administer federal programs, and you'll hear again more about these in detail later on, but the Get Ready program, so funded through the federal Gear Up funding. We also have a robust research division, and so we collect, maintain, and report data on students and post-secondary institutions, outcome data primarily. And we offer technical assistance and training around the intersection of campus sexual misconduct and implementation of federal Title IX as well. I had mentioned our research function, so research and report on the effectiveness of post-secondary institutions, and of course, are focused on post-secondary access and attainment. And, that's outlined here a little bit with what we call within the agency internally is the four A's. maybe a shot at a bad joke, but, you know, being a higher ed agency, we give ourselves straight A's. So we organize ourselves, organize ourselves around four key areas within our strategic vision of the agency. Those are access, affordability, attainment, and accountability. So you can see under the access heading, those are really programs and supports to increase equitable access to Minnesota's post-secondary education opportunities. And so programs like direct admissions, I had mentioned before, the Get Ready program, our dual training grants, FAFSA completion work, as well as providing resources both to students and parents, families, to assist with college planning and exploration and ultimately choice. Under the affordability heading, of course, that really encompasses the administration of all of our state financial aid programs, again, like the Minnesota State Grant and North Star Promise. But also included within affordability is that option for the Minnesota self-loan, those tuition reciprocity agreements, student loan counseling, and then some specific financial aid options. When we get into those program and line item overviews, you'll be able to see those specific supports. For attainment, which I'm actually going to walk into shortly here after this slide, primarily focused on programs and supports to move the state forward to meeting our legislative attainment goal, our statewide attainment goal. So that work includes primarily, working with currently enrolled students like the in initiatives like the Student Parent Support Initiative, campus support for implementing sexual violence and prevention programming, a lot of work around the basic needs support, whole student supports, and emergency grants. And then finally, in accountability, making sure again that our post-secondary institutions with our regulatory function are appropriately licensed and registered, as well as that research function, data collection and reporting on the effectiveness of our institutions. So that's how we are strategically organized within the agency. Just a snapshot of the agency funding profile. You can see that we do receive a majority of our funding through the state general fund. That's 76% of our overall funding profile. And over 98% of those general fund dollars go directly out the door, appropriated to serve students, whether that's through direct financial aid or passed through to student-serving organizations. So a really lean and mean agency with just a small fraction of those general fund dollars appropriated for agency administration. The next largest slice of the pie there, of course, federal funding, and that is primarily the Get Ready grant through federal Gear Up dollars. And then, that was the other bucket. So the small slice was the federal dollars I had just referenced. The other includes the Minnesota self-loan and then our programming related to licensing and registration, our regulatory function, as well as the special revenue accounts there, primarily for those programs that run a little bit longer than the biennial funding window, so like the spinal cord traumatic brain injury research and others. So I mentioned Minnesota's educational attainment goal. Just as a level set, although I assume everyone's at least somewhat familiar with the goal the legislature set in 2015. And that goal is a really ambitious one. We actually have one of the loftiest statewide attainment goals in the nation. And there are 49 states with statewide overall attainment goals. For Minnesota, our goal set in 2015 by the legislature was to have 70% of Minnesota adults aged 25 to 44 attain some sort of post-secondary credential beyond high school. And so that includes, of course, anything like a certificate, a diploma, and then, of course, degrees, an associate's degree, a four-year degree, all the way through professional degrees. The foresight of the legislature at the time was really important to include not only that 70% goal in the aggregate, but also to set that 70% goal for all racial and ethnic categories as well, and to set benchmarks within the statutory language to make sure that we are staying on track equitably throughout the state. And Minnesota actually, again, not only has one of the loftiest goals, but also has one of the highest attainment rates in the nation, currently sitting at about 63.3%. We're battling with Massachusetts and, new data that came out recently from the Lumina Foundation and their Stronger Nation report, who leads a lot of this nationwide attainment work, reported that states like Colorado and Utah now are surpassing Minnesota. And so still we are our top four, top five in the nation for overall educational attainment. And you can see there at least 56.9% have an associate's degree and a 6.5% at the certificate level. This is outlined in the attainment report. I won't go through it in great detail other than to let you know that, again, recognizing the legislature's foresight here to disaggregate data by race and ethnicity has been incredibly important because it has helped the legislature make decisions around support programs that are necessary for specific populations of students. And so you can see, that overall we are at that 63.3% number there. We have made incremental increases in attainment overall over the last nine plus years. But we have some significant gaps too. We have the highest or one of the highest attainment rates in the nation. We also have some of the highest nation leading gaps in the nation as well. Overall, to meet our statewide attainment goal, and I had mentioned this is a 10-year goal set in 2015. We are now in 2025. We are more than likely not going to meet that goal. We need overall another 101,000, close to 102,000 Minnesota adults to attain some sort of credential beyond high school. But you can see there the number needed to be able to reach that goal, not only overall, but equitably as well. So certainly some work to do there to close those gaps. And then here are just a little bit of the same data, just represented in a different way around certificates and then degrees. So you can see that for some racial and ethnic communities, the higher representation of attainment at the certificate level versus the degree level, and some of the disparities there. So again, helping to inform some of those programmatic and investment decisions by the legislature. Again, not only being limited to the federal race categories, but also the ability for our data to be disaggregated to an even more granular level, having the opportunity to disaggregate by ethnicity as well. And so digging a little bit deeper into those federal legacy race categories, again, we can see disparities even within and amongst communities. So there's one example there and another example there. So, Minnesota has been praised and lauded nationally for our ability to disaggregate data to a more granular level. And that is in part due to the relationships built within this work with, entities like the State Demographer's Office utilizing U.S. Census data. And, even getting involved in new opportunities like the PSEO project, and that's not post-secondary enrollment options, but rather post-secondary employment outcomes, a new project by the U.S. Census. And that's actually going to help us. I'm kind of previewing some later talking points, but that's actually going to allow us to have conversations and be more well-informed around, we understand students leave Minnesota to go to college and, do make choices in neighboring states, but we see them coming back. And so that data helps us, understand kind of if students leave and we are, a net exporter of students, do we get our students back to actually, come here, get a job, raise a family and contribute to the Minnesota economy. And so, proud to be able to have incorporate that type of data in the attainment work as well. So I kind of mentioned most of this already. I'm going to go back to that slide. Primarily just want to preview, because I know Chair Rarick in particular last year, you had interest in having this conversation about what our next stage of attainment is. And so this is maybe, an opportunity to request a further conversation about that with the committee and with the legislature overall, because we are in 2025. But of course, the language is unclear of, are we talking about fiscal year 25? Are we talking about school year 25? Is this calendar year 25? If it's data year 25, we've got a little bit more time because, we look back on that data delay 1 to 2 years to actually, help us inform this data. But, I'd mentioned the Lumina Foundation and other entities, other states are setting new attainment goals, kind of re-upping to 2035. what's right for Minnesota. So I'd love to have that conversation here. And, you know, that's, of course, work we are leading internally and with our partners, but recognize that the legislature is a key partner in that decision making and in that work. So wanted to put that there for the committee to consider. Oops. Now I'm going back. So just wanted to talk a little bit about our OHI initiatives. And this is, if you do have your spreadsheet in front of you that was prepared for the committee, this will relate to line 34. And apologies for kind of bouncing around a little, but you can see the related appropriation. And it is also on the screen there for you. But in 2023, the agency had the opportunity with the support of the legislature.
Commissioner, sorry, I'm going to interrupt just for 1 second because the line 34 that he's referencing is actually on the smaller spreadsheet, but you are, let's see. Yeah, so that's, you're talking about the Director of Tribal Relations on line 34 of the smaller spreadsheet, and the bigger spreadsheet that I had them pull out, it's, let's see. Well, yeah, that's it. It's large animal on our other spreadsheet. So, but you go ahead and talk about it, and because it's very important to this committee. But just so that people aren't confused, because I'm like, oh, that's the wrong spreadsheet. So we will. I'll let you continue on with the tribe relations director. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the clarification there. Certainly didn't want to have folks bouncing between two spreadsheets there if they are different. So yes, the smaller spreadsheet prepared for the committee. On line 34 talks about our work with the tribal relations director. And I mentioned in the 2023 session, we had the opportunity with the support of the legislature to finally meet our statutory obligation to have a tribal relations director to meet the statutory language in Minnesota statute 10.65 to meaningfully consult with all federally recognized tribal nations within the state. And so, you know, finally we're able to hire that director, and he has hit the ground running. And we appreciate having the opportunity to have him with the agency to be able to meet those statutory obligations. He's been working closely with the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, with the Tribal Nations Education Committee, and has been, you know, working with other tribal relations directors and tribal liaisons, amongst other state agencies to complete that work. And of course, he and I have hit the road a few times already, consulting directly on a government-to-government basis with tribal nations on all issues concerning higher ed. And so thankful that he's finally a part of the agency, and appreciate the legislature's support there in helping us to meet that statutory requirement.
And I will note for the committee too, as you're looking for the next thing, that we will have the tribal communities come in. So our three tribal nations that we gave $1 million each of O&M for each year. So they're going to come back and report back to us on how that was helpful and how many students they have and so on. So that is on the agenda coming up. So thank you, Commissioner Olson, for teeing that up for us. Can you please continue?
Thank you. I'll be talking about what's line 14 on the small spreadsheet, and that is our student parent information appropriation. One of the things that's nice about our agency is that we ask ourselves the question of, you know, what's OHI's lane? What are we well positioned to do as a state agency that nobody else in the space can do? And one of those things is giving students and parents unbiased, accurate information to help them begin their college search process, to consider college options, to do a little bit of career exploration, and for a lot of families, really importantly, getting information about all their different financial aid options, both at the federal level and at the state level. And so as part of that work, we have virtual and print publications and resources related to college access, financial aid information, college readiness. If you ever visit us at the state fair, we have a big table with lots of great brochures. I can tell you that the financial aid and the paying for college ones are the brochures that we sell out of the most quickly there. You'll see some examples of some of our publications in the folder that you do have in front of you. And this funding also supports programs like our Ready, Set, FAFSA initiative, which is a series of virtual workshops for students and parents all about navigating FAFSA, how to complete a FAFSA, and some other related topics. If you will recall, last year was a very, very difficult year for FAFSA due to changes that happened at the federal level. And I think that work was more important than ever because students and families really had a lot of confusion, concerns, and we knew that FAFSA, it opened late, it was really challenging for folks to access. And so we would typically see between 200 and 400 people signed up for each virtual event. Even this year, in a more normal FAFSA year, we've already had over 2,200 unique registrations for our Ready, Set, FAFSA events this year. And so that's a really great opportunity for students all over the state to be able to access our expertise and to be able to access that information so that they can be really well equipped to begin their college search process. And then we do try to make sure that those events are accessible to families of all kinds throughout the state, and so do offer translators on hand to help families with questions where English may not be their first language. We also work closely with our different college access partners in the state, and often will co-present so that we're able to, again, reach out to every corner of the state to publicize this information.
That goes faster.
Quick trigger finger there. All right, next we'll be looking at line 51, which is direct admissions, which is one of my, not that I don't love all of our programs, but a program that's very near and dear to my heart. Direct admissions is our proactive admissions process, and this is the program that Minnesota has set up to make sure that all students who are able to graduate from a high school in Minnesota know that they have post-secondary options and know that they have college options available to them. As part of this program, students in the beginning part of their senior year will get a letter that's personalized to them based on their academic performance through their junior year of high school that lets them know a list of colleges and universities in our state that say, you're in. If you submit an application, you are guaranteed that you'll be accepted. And it's a really nice opportunity to take some of the anxiety out of the college search process. As part of the direct admissions model, we also have waived application fees, so students can apply to schools without having to incur those college application fees. It just gives them a lot of confidence going into that process. We are in our third cohort year of our direct admissions program, and I'll give you a hint that our direct admissions report will be coming out in the next couple weeks, but I'm going to give you a little sneak preview of some of our data and some of our findings that we've seen from this program. We currently have 55 colleges and universities participating, and that includes community colleges, technical colleges, tribal colleges, public 4 years, private 4 years as well. When you look at direct admissions models across the country, and direct admissions is a model that we're seeing more and more states take on. I think we've been contacted by, I think we're up to 18 or 19 states that have called us to say, can you tell us how you do it? Tell us how your model works. Every state we talk to, they say, oh, wow, you guys are really big. Because most other states don't have that inclusive focus where they're including both 2 years and 4 years, privates and publics, and that's something that we really built into the program from day one, and we think is a real competitive advantage of our model. As you can see, the table listed here is our year in progress, and so these are not final numbers because the direct admissions window is open until the end of the spring 25 session, but this kind of gives you a sense of how many of the different types of institutions within the direct admissions model, where are they getting requests from students from? And so you can see each of those counts is, so Minnesota State two-year colleges has had over 17,000 requests for admissions through our direct admissions pilot and so on. One of the questions that came up for some colleges and universities was, you know, are students going to just select all and they're going to get a list of, you know, 29 or 55 colleges and they're just going to select all of them and we're not going to know if they're actually really interested in our institution? And what we found is that that's not the case. The average student is choosing between 4 and 6 colleges through the direct admissions pilot, which is a really appropriate number and kind of in a line with how students will usually approach their college search process. Direct admissions, one of the things is also really important to us is that students are not limited with their choice. It's not prescriptive on our part. So we're not going to tell them, we think you should go to this college or we think you should go to that college, because we want them to look at that list and use that to kickstart their exploration to think about, what makes sense for me geographically? What makes sense for me based on the academic program I want to go into? What makes sense for me from a cost perspective? And I want to mention the cost perspective because one of the other sort of the primary goal of direct admissions is, of course, to increase our enrollment from graduating from high school to enrolling in the fall immediately afterwards. Within that goal, we also have a couple other smaller goals, one of which is to keep more Minnesota students in Minnesota, and then it's also to increase the number of students who are completing their FAFSA. We know that we want students to complete their FAFSA. We don't want them to leave money on the table. We want them to access those Pell Grants, those federal aid programs. We want them to access our state financial aid programs. And so some of the data that I'll share is kind of how we're meeting those measures and what kind of progress we're seeing on that. So this is a quick snapshot of how the program has expanded. Direct admissions from the beginning has always been built with the goal to scale, ultimately to serve every public high school in Minnesota. We're also continuing to work with any schools, private parochial schools that might be interested, alternative learning centers that might be interested in competency-based high schools, online high schools. We are casting a wide net. At this point, no high school that has that wishes to participate in direct admissions hasn't been given the opportunity to do so. And so we've really grown through the three years of the program so far, as you can see on the map. We really wanted to make sure that this was representing all of Minnesota, that it was hitting as many of our communities as we possibly can. So in year one, we're in 46 high schools, year two, 120, year three, 182. Our goal will be to continue to add until we hit that saturation of every public high school. This year, we'll have over 32,000 high school seniors who are attending direct admissions high schools. I also want to note that our direct admissions program is also getting a little bit of additional support from the Lumina Foundation. They have reached out we're interested in our model and interested in working with us. And so one of the ways that we are continuing to expand the program is by using funds from the Lumina Foundation through a grant called the Connect to College. And as part of that grant, we are doing regional high school counselor convening. So myself and another member of the agency we've been to Bemidji and Rochester and Duluth and kind of hitting all the corners of the state, hosting professional development opportunities for high school counselors where we're providing training on financial aid, other professional development topics, and then also using that as a way to get them interested and engaged in direct admissions and kind of jumpstart them to become a direct admission school if they're not already there. Doing some other cool things with that grant as well, but in the interest of time, we'll just kind of keep moving forward. So now we're going to get into the good stuff. You can see some of our data and our outcomes so far. As I mentioned, one of the things that we really wanted to see was the increase in the number of students completing their FAFSA. And I will note this chart looks at all of the entire senior class for direct admissions high schools, regardless of whether the student opted in for the direct admissions program or not. So in a direct admissions high school, all of the seniors will get their letter, their personalized letter of their options. In that letter, they will get information about financial aid that hits on the importance of financial aid and some other resources there. Not every student who gets a direct admissions letter will do anything with it. Some students will look at it and move on. Maybe they've already made their college choices. Maybe they know that they know where they want to go. Whether they decide to opt in with direct admissions or not, we still think there's value for them getting that message around, that additional message and outreach around financial aid and about their college options. And so this chart shows that students who are at direct admissions high schools, the nice upward trajectory of the percentage of them that are completing their FAFSA. One of the things that I want to point out is that I was nervous about what this chart would look like given how tough last year was in terms of FAFSA. And it's really important to note that nationally, for the senior class of 2024, the rate of the senior class of 2024 that completed a FAFSA nationally was down 9%. In Minnesota, we did better than that. We were down about 4.5%. But in our direct admissions high schools, we actually went up. And so that, I think, demonstrates that that's a pretty powerful intervention because we are being really intentional with getting that financial aid messaging to the students. We are always wanting to be mindful of that looking at the populations of students that we're serving through this program. And so looking at the percentage completing FAFSA broken down by race and ethnicity, and you can see the chart there. One thing that I do want to point out, as you can see in the American Indian and Alaska Native column, or that chart on the left, that was the only group that we really saw a notable decline in this year. And obviously, we want to dig into that a little bit more and find out what that was about. One thing that I will note is it's not an apples-to-apples comparison because the number of American Indian students we served in the program increased really dramatically from year one to year two. So in the first year of the program, we had 99 students that identified as American Indian. And in year two, we had 579. And then in year three, we have 902. And so those numbers are going to be, I think, a little bit in flux because that population has gotten larger. But we know that that's an area that we want to continue to make sure that we're doing the appropriate outreaches and interventions to that population.
Assistant Commissioner Robinson, can I just ask you a question at this juncture?
Yeah.
So since we put a million a year for O&M for each of the tribal colleges in the north, so Leech Lake, White Earth, Leech Lake, and Red Lake, Is it possible that because they've got better support that they're staying there as opposed to going somewhere else, and maybe that's some of the dip that you're seeing? Because we did do a significant policy change.
Thank you for that question, Chair Rarick. You know, I don't know, because this would be looking backwards a year ago, and so I don't know that that would be a correlation there. And I would hope that those students would still complete a FAFSA regardless of where they're attending to make sure that they're, you know, continuing to access Pell Grant or other federal financial aid dollars that might be available to them. So I'm not aware of a connection.
They are participating.
Yeah. But we do have participation from most of those colleges in the direct admissions model as well.
Oh, you do? That's fantastic. Okay. Thank you. Please continue. It just made me think about it, because they're going to be here soon, and we'll see how they're doing with additional $1 million per year for their O&M. Thank you. Please continue.
One of the other measures that we look at is comparing this population of students who are free and reduced lunch eligible and the students who are not free and reduced lunch eligible, and wanting to make sure that we're providing equity of opportunity for those populations of students. And so you can see the blue line is the students who are eligible for free and reduced lunch. So those are the students who are probably more likely to qualify for things like the Pell Grant and the State Grant and the North Star Promise. And then the green line is the percent of students who are not free and reduced lunch eligible. So you can see that we've continued to see that line increase in the positive direction for both populations. Ultimately, we'd like to see no difference between those lines and to see them come a little bit closer to each other. And then this is looking at our percentage of direct admissions students who are staying enrolled in the state of Minnesota. We know that we continue to be a net exporter of high school graduates, but we're hoping that the direct admissions model really encourages students to take a good look at our options within Minnesota and to be really aware of our Minnesota State financial aid programs and opportunities that they have. And so we can see that we're seeing some improvement in that measure as well, in keeping up some more of those students here in state. And this is looking at our percentage of students who are staying in college in Minnesota, broken down by race and ethnicity category. And the one line that's not going in the right direction is, again, that American Indian student population. And so we know that that's an area we need to continue to do some additional work and research into how to best serve that population of students. Looking forward, we will continue to scale this program. We anticipate adding another 100 high schools for the program year of 2025-2026. We are currently actively recruiting high schools to join that cohort. We continuing to expand to be as inclusive as possible for a variety of types of high schools. Looking at our alternative learning centers, tribally affiliated high schools, competency-based high schools. We want to make the program as easy as possible for high schools and for colleges and universities that are participating. And so every year we refine our processes. We get a little bit better at doing what we're doing. We get a little bit more streamlined, and we get we make the onboarding a little bit easier for our high schools. And so we're continuing to implement process improvements every year. And then continuing the collaboration with community access groups, with foundations, and with other interested stakeholders who are as excited about this work as we are. And then we know that the one piece of feedback that from the beginning we've been really mindful of is, again, that embedding that financial aid information. And so we've also expanded to have some different short videos available for students and families about how to do the FAFSA, about how to interpret a financial aid letter, again, building out a more robust portfolio of resources in that space. All right, so now we will transition to our Get Ready program, and this will be line 48 on your small spreadsheet. And line 48 will refer to the state's appropriation toward Get Ready. The bulk of the money for the Get Ready program does come from our federally funded grant. And I know I said direct admissions was one of my favorite programs and dear to my heart. Surprise, so is Get Ready. This is another program that I really love the opportunity to talk about. And so Get Ready is program that's really designed to start in middle school and to provide middle and high school students with programming designed to improve their post-secondary outcomes, to improve their academic readiness for college, to increase their college-going behaviors, like making sure that they have good attendance in high school, that they're accessing tutoring if they need it, that they know how to complete financial aid application, they know how to do a college search. And in this program, based on the federal eligibility guidelines, is really targeted towards students who are coming from low-income backgrounds. And we also know we have a high percentage of students who are first-generation students that are served as well. Every year we provide data back to the federal government as a part of our mandatory accountability for this program. And so we know that every year we're tracking all the different efforts that we have and the different interventions that we have and ultimately looking to see once they get to their senior year, what happens to the students from those schools. And so we know from our last cohort that 4 out of our 7 partner high schools, again, saw an increase in their FAFSA completion rate. And then 5 out of our 7 partner high schools saw substantially increased college enrollment rates after high school graduation, which is exactly what this program is designed to do. In 2024, we successfully renewed our grant through the federal government. It was an incredibly, incredibly difficult competition, very, very, very competitive. We were one of, I think, only 9 states that were funded to continue, and so that's really exciting for us to be able to continue to serve Minnesota in that way. We will provide post-secondary support services to over 7,500 students in our 14 capacity-building schools, and then that will also include an additional scholarship opportunity for students once they do get to that senior year and are enrolling in a Minnesota institution. Next, we will turn to our State Longitudinal Educational Data System, or SLEDS, and ECLDS. This is line 54 on the small spreadsheet. And SLEDS and ECLDS are our ability to often tell you how well we're doing in some of these really important measures that we want to track, like what are the return on investment for students who are going and completing a credential, where are our students going, who's being left behind, where do we need to have additional interventions. And so they exist to monitor, evaluate, and improve the delivery of our education services to Minnesota families and students. They are the basis of reports around Minnesota attainment goal. They are what allows us to disaggregate things by race and ethnicity and free and reduced lunch status and lots of other criteria. This SLEDS is what gives us the resources to look at some of our legislatively mandated reports, like our Getting Prepared report, which looks at high school students and developmental education when they enroll in post-secondary. It's where information that MDE will use for its federally mandated report card, DEED for the WIOA reporting and dual training grants. What's really nice about SLEDS, And I'll be really candid, when we talk to other states, they are often really jealous of how well-developed our SLEDS and our ECLDS systems are. And so that's something I think we can really hold as a point of pride. And, you know, data is how we know what we're doing, and data is how we tell our people that we love them, because you can't care for what you can't count in education. And so SLEDS really allows us to ask really good questions and provide really accurate information for both the state. And it also allows some for external researchers to be able to conduct research into Minnesota's outcomes as well. ECLDS is our early childhood longitudinal data system. And so that is where data collected by MDE, DHS, MDH, kind of all come together in one online interactive database. And so that's really designed to look at what happens to students before they're ready to move into post-secondary education, on growth and achievement, and how they're participating in various educational and social programs over time. In 2024, the ECLDS staff were moved into the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, but the funding and IT support for that initiative is still included in OHE's budget. And I could pause if there's any questions about anything I've covered before.
I'm going to do a little pause right here, yes. Representative Cleburne.
May I ask just a question about that last statement?
You may ask away, Representative Cleburne.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being with us today, and I always appreciate your enthusiasm for the work that you do. You're probably one of the best-run departments. I appreciate that. My question is that last conversation that you just had about the money, are the staff moving to Children, Youth, and Families, but the funding and IT support have stayed with you? Is that for continuity of data, or is that, I'm just confused as to why that's happened. I mean, I'm glad you have it, but.
Assistant Commissioner Robinson.
Yes, thank you, Chair Rick, and thank you, Representative Cleburne. SLEDS and ECLDS kind of are uniquely positioned because they're actually under sort of the P20 umbrella, which is OHE, but not totally OHE, if that makes sense. And so the work has continued in the same way that it did because they're in that combined relationship under P20.
for some clean work?
No, that's great. And I'm glad to know that the data is going to be kept and it will be done in a consistent manner to previous years, correct? All right, thank you.
Great. Since we're paused here, any other quick questions at this juncture? Not seeing any. Okay, please continue, Assistant Commissioner Robinson.
All right, now we will look at lines 55 and 56. And this is, if you think back to our 4As, this is where we're starting to get into our team and some of our efforts to support students once they're already enrolled and making sure that their experiences while they're on campus are safe and productive and they're able to meet their personal, educational, and professional goals while they're a college student. And so we do have funding that assists with our campus sexual assault reporting, and so that is the reporting that campuses are required to do, and where they submit information around different incidents that may have happened on campus or been reported on campus, and that provides us the ability to see sort of big picture what's happening, to have that information is available for students and parents as they are maybe considering their college options and wanting to know a little bit more about maybe the campus safety profile of a school that they might be considering. We also know that it's not just enough to report incidents that happen. We want to prevent incidents from happening. We want all students to feel safe on campus. And so we are, again, well-positioned to be a resource for our campuses and to provide ongoing training and support around sexual violence prevention. Also to provide ongoing training and support around changes to the federal Title IX statute. That's a statute that, depending on as different administrations come and go, they may interpret different parts of that legislation differently, and so it sometimes can feel like a little bit of a moving target, and so just trying to be able to say, okay, there's a new Dear Colleague letter. This is what it means. Here's how it applies to your campus. Here's something that you might need to do differently, or here's questions that it's raising for us, and to be able to try to provide that support for campuses, because we know that folks who are doing Title IX and sexual violence prevention work on campuses are often wearing multiple hats, really overwhelmed sometimes, and so if we can provide resources and assistance, we're glad to do that. Some of the examples of activities that we fund through this appropriation include our prevention and response coordinator, who's the point person that takes on this work, and hosts events like our sexual violence prevention summit, designed to provide, again, best practices to prevent and respond to sexual misconduct on campuses, providing regular opportunities for meeting and networking and, again, sharing best practices for campus prevention specialists and Title IX coordinators, training on best practices for conducting investigations. As you know, we know that technology changes, making sure that we are, what does it mean to do a Title IX investigation for an online student? What does it mean if somebody is being harassed online versus in person? And again, it's an evolving field, and so providing that important training. And then trying to identify where we have kind of specialized topics or things that are kind of emerging issues within that field. And so training on things like trauma-informed care, stalking, intimate partner violence, risk assessment, restorative justice, the intersection of sexual violence prevention and students who have autism or autism spectrum disorders, how to have healthy relationships in the digital age. And so this is really a place where we don't really provide any direct support to the students per se, but we're providing direct support to the campus staff that are working with students in this space.
Ms. Oliver.
All right, so I'm going to do a swivel and put on a different hat, I guess, because our grants manager couldn't be here, or our financial aid manager. So I'm going to go through a bunch of programs, and I know you guys have a lot of questions, especially about the grants program, so I'm going to do my best to answer them. Might have to do some follow-up. But we have a program called the Summer Academic Enrichment Program. It started kind of as I think we had some one-time funding. It was kind of a side program years ago, and then we were able to get some ongoing state funding, and it became a permanent program. We actually, for this program, there's always a wait list. We never have enough money for this program, which is a good thing. This is a line 38 on your small spreadsheet. Obviously, we're the land of 10,000 acronyms, so this is SAEP, so I will refer to it as SAEP. As you can see on the slide, of the funding, we did use some federal funding at one time during COVID to help fund 935 students because we wanted to deal with that loss of learning during summer programming. So the program provides a stipend on a first-come, first-served basis for students in grades 3 through 11 to attend an eligible summer enrichment program. I think we pay up to $1,000 per student to attend those programs. A lot of the programs will also chip in and cover additional costs for students as they apply. A lot of the programs are science-based programs. We have Concordia, Learning Language Village, St. Cloud University, Wolf Ridge, for example. Last summer, we supported over 586 students with $242,000. And as the commissioner mentioned, and as you all know, all of our programs have been maxed out to capacity, so we weren't able to put additional funds in this program like we sometimes are able to, unfortunately, in the last year. But yeah, so the next thing is it still me? Oh, it's still me. Cool. Well, I luckily get to talk about this program. I was around for this program too, to actually get this program off the ground when I was over the grants department in our agency, the David Thomasoni ALS Research Grant. We got one-time money of $20 million to do a competitive grant to fund research in ALS. So we did that in fiscal year 2024. We were able to fund five grantees with that funding. We still have money, obviously, left over. We used $20 million. We did contract out to get experts to help do the review and competition for that process because we are not ALS experts at OHE. But yes. Still me too. Am I doing next gen too? So we are actually, so these next few slides, I'll go through fairly quickly because they are one-time funded. I know you want to talk more base funded programs, but we felt like it was necessary to just talk about some of the work. We are still kind of doing some of these programs, but Next Gen Nursing Initiative, it was one-time funded. But it was ran through Minnesota State it started off as a initiative of the governor's to increase certified nursing assistants in the state, especially during COVID. Remember, he deployed a National Guard to fill that gap, and then we did a one-time initiative, which was really successful. So we got some one-time money in 2023, and that money went straight to Minn State, who ran the program with this one-time funding, and this was the outcome. I won't go and read the slide. Here are some other one-time funding programs. We ran Early Childhood and Family Education Teacher Shortage Grant to increase programming there and get more individuals in that field, especially in through the University of Minnesota. And then MICC, they were in the base funding last year. They were ticking out of the base, but they had an appropriation of $2 million, and they serve individuals on the autism spectrum in a residential program. And then the paramedic scholarships, and that was actually, that came out of the House. I believe that was Coulter's bill, Representative Coulter's bill. So that was one-time funded in good work to our comms director and financial aid program managers who promoted that program. And these are some studies and other one-time fundings that we had did. So feasibility study on workforce, and we can provide you with the report and the outcomes of these studies and reports, and then a course placement report that we collaborated with Minn State on. And I'll pass it back over to you, Assistant Commissioner Robinson.
Thank you, Ms. Oliver. I would say, too, that we will have a day when we're going to have some of the nonprofits and some of these one-time appropriations folks come in and present to us. Before you joined us, and we're so glad you're here, we had ongoing conversations on this side, and we worked, talked a lot about the base of appropriations, and so that's kind of what they're referring to. We kind of lived in the land of what's in our base, but we will be hearing from some of the one-time funding folks as well, and some of the nonprofits specifically, and from the tribal colleges. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over, I believe, to Assistant Commissioner Robinson, right? Okay.
Yes, thank you. I did want to note that the report on the course placement practices will be forthcoming. It should be released in the next few weeks. That work has been concluded. We're just making sure that all the everything is spelled correctly and we get it through the ADA process. So that will be coming very, very soon. So we're excited to have that completed. An additional Okay. One of the other projects that was a really big focus following the 2023 legislative session was on the topic of student basic needs. And this really fits into our attainment, again, toward the attainment goal. We know that students who are hungry have a hard time learning. We know that when students have difficulties with their economic stability, where they have, you know, a $600 car repair can make the difference between them making it to campus and going to class and not. And we also know that our campuses around the state have been doing a lot of work around basic needs and trying to support students through food pantries, through emergency grants, through different initiatives that they have. And so this was an opportunity for us to come together and try to take a really broad look to see where are we at and what's the next generation or what's the next step where the state and specifically the legislature could potentially provide some additional support in this area. And so as part of this legislation, we convened what I think is probably still the largest working group that I've ever had to convene, because it was, as it was very thoughtfully pointed out in the legislation, we wanted to make sure that all the stakeholders were represented. And so our working group included students, first and foremost, OHE staff, staff from the Minnesota State System Office, faculty and staff from Minnesota State campuses, representatives of private colleges, representatives from the University of Minnesota, representatives from community groups as well, representatives from the Hope Foundation or the Hope Center, which really focuses on college student basic needs. And we spent the better part of a year asking the question, what could the legislature do by either with additional funding, by removing a barrier, or providing support in particular areas? The report from this working group was released in September 2024. It is, if you have had a chance to look at it, it is very comprehensive. We wrote it with the understanding that there was no universe where all of the recommendations would ever move forward unless you wanted to give OHE $5 billion. We don't want $5 billion. But we wanted to identify both what are some immediate opportunities and what are things that would really require 5 to 10 years of a runway to be able to really see some interventions. And so since that report has been released, you know, it's publicly available, we're interested in kind of continuing that work and continuing that collaboration with our college and university partners. Some of the work that has stemmed from following the completion of, this working group are some exciting initiatives. Minnesota was just selected as one of the 7 states in the country to participate in a SHEO Basic Needs Academy around, and it's a Basic Needs Academy specifically around data. And so our nerdy hearts are really happy about this because this is an opportunity for us to figure out how do we better know which interventions related to basic needs have the biggest impacts. Because we want to make sure that the funds that we're spending on basic needs are really doing what we want them to do, which is encouraging more students to complete their college education. And so this will be an opportunity. It'll be a 3-year program. Again, it's a cross-functional group with representatives from the University of Minnesota, from the Minnesota State System, from OHE, from the Private College Council, to really look at how do we better track and collect data around this population of students. We've also been doing some work to get a better sense of the current state of emergency food resources and food pantries on our campus, on our campuses. We believe that most campuses at this point are doing something around having emergency resources for students, but some campuses have been able to really well develop out a standalone pantry that has, you know, commercial grade refrigeration, and they're able to have perishable items for students. Some campuses are still not quite there yet, so we wanted to get a better sense of, like, what are the barriers that you're facing? What is your sort of end state goal around meeting the kind of the most immediate of the basic needs a student might face? And then we know that the FAFSA completion, you've heard us talk about it in a couple of different categories. We know how important that is, and we know that a very good first step to making sure students have some financial stability is that they have not left money on the table that they are entitled to. And so wanting to make sure that we are integrating FAFSA completion both for students who are entering into higher education for the first time, but also for continuing and current students who maybe have missed that opportunity in the past. So continuing some efforts around that as well.
Deb
is going back to you.
Not
me.
Ms.
Oliver.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair, committee members. So we also were gifted an additional $1 million for the Minnesota Aspiring Teachers of Color Scholarship. It was initially a pilot program to also encourage and increase the number of teachers of color. The goal of the program was to fund individuals while they're in school and encourage them to go into teaching and to cover their cost of college. So last
year, I believe, was where we got the additional $1 million through the K-12 committee. And this is the data and results of that programming. And again, it was another one-time funded initiative out of our agency. External supports. Okay, now we're getting into what are called the legislatively named grants ran out of our agency. And similar to competitive grants, we do all of the same checking. So we collect financial data like 1099s, pre-award for legislatively named grants. Obviously, legislatively named grants meaning that you all named this grantee prior to us funding them. So we don't have to do a competition, but post-award, we still do all of the same things we do with competitive grants. But MEC, which I believe you all will have them in front of you all, so I won't go into too much detail about them. But it is line 47 on your small spreadsheet. And MNEP, Minnesota Education Equity Partnership, is line 49 on your small spreadsheet. So Minnesota pays dues, and the commissioner can always jump in because he interacts with them a lot more than I do on what our interactions with MEC are, if you wanted to. I didn't know if you wanted to at all. Chime in a little bit about MEC. Sure.
Commissioner Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Yeah, appreciate the phone a friend there. Yeah, so those maybe not members not as familiar with the work of the Midwest Higher Education Compact. There are four regional compacts throughout the country. MEC is our regional compact that Minnesota is a member of, and there is duplicate statutory language in each of the member states that outlines the responsibilities of the state as a member of a compact. And as part of that, the state is required to appropriate the $115,000 annual dues, so that remains in the base budget. But MEC has a few different functions. I think one of the most significant being cost savings. They're eligible to take advantage of primarily cost saving technology grants, as well as insurance cost savings, health insurance for students. But you know, MEC also has a responsibility to oversee the reciprocity agreements, MSARA, the statewide distance education agreements, and that's a responsibility of all the regional compacts. And so Minnesota, along with 12 Midwest states, comprise the compact, and both members of the legislature and governor's appointees serve as commissioners representing the state within the compact.
Ms. Oliver.
Thanks, Chair. So MNEP, again, acronyms, Minnesota Education Equity Partnership, which I believe you all also will have in front of you, and they can do a better job explaining what their organization does. But we do give them a small $40,000 a year a grant, and they do a racial equity collaboration partnership. They have been helping us gather information and helping us with work around the educational attainment goals, and just helping us in spaces in which, like, the agency is not always able to be in different places all the time. In Minnesota Equity Partnership, Education Equity Partnership does a lot of that work. They also have a college equity advisory council that they convene that also helps inform our agency with multiple institutions, cross-sector, and then community involvement. And former Representative Mariani is their executive director. MinLink and Minitex is, we provide them a little over $6.5 million a year in their interlibrary interface, so online library system. They're actually housed at the University of Minnesota, but funded through our office. They also receive some funding from MDE, but it's a fraction of what our agency is providing them. College Possible, Minitex is on line 53 of your small spreadsheet, and College Possible is line 46 of that small spreadsheet. I will note that College Possible is one-time funded, so they're not in the base. And that appropriation was to support College Prosper's mission, but also I believe it was also to expand into more rural Minnesota high schools was my understanding of their appropriation. So shifting into the competitive grants, I guess I'll pause too if there's questions about the legislatively named grants that are listed. There's more, there's medical grants, but that's later in the slide, that are also legislatively named grants.
Thank you, Ms. Oliver. I think we have a question from Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this actually goes back to your the summer enrichment program. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering why something that's intended for third graders through 11th grade is in the higher ed program versus K-12. And I don't know if it's because, I guess the second question would be, do the programs in the summer enrichment program have to be at colleges, or can they be at other entities? Can a preschool, for instance, or can a, I don't know, you name it, another, just a public school or any school offer a summer enrichment program and qualify for those grants?
Ms. Oliver.
Chair Representative Scott. So we do have a criteria for evaluating participating organizations, and they have to be summer academic enrichment programs, and they usually lead to college access, and they're usually college prep intensive. And I can send a list of those programs, a lot of them. So like Breakthrough Twin Cities, they don't have to be at a college, but like we have Health Force Minnesota, St. Cloud State University, the works, but the type of programming they're offering is kind of college intensive activity. There's a lot of nursing program, like summer nursing type programs, but I think it's because of the type of programming they're offering is more than likely why it ended up being an OHE initiative. And my predecessor in the grants department was the one that kind of started the initiative in OHE. So it's like academic rigor and college prep was kind of the focus. College readiness was the focus or the intention behind it. But yeah.
Okay.
So, and I can find and get more background too. And again, the program manager, the one that runs this program, they have a criteria for evaluating what organizations get to participate in SAEP as an eligible institution.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just trying to make sure that was in the right spot. It just seemed like if it's for 3rd through 11th grade, it seemed like it should be in the K-12 area. Just a kind of a follow-up question, and it's not necessarily this program, but you'd mentioned the nursing pieces that happen in the summer, but more broadly, the nursing, the CNA program. Are we finding, or is there any data kept on the number of those CNAs that have gone on then to become RNs? I know we're, especially during COVID, we were trying to fill that that need for CNAs. And my hope is that some of those people would go on to be RNs since we have such a shortage in that area as well.
Thank you. Commissioner Olson, do you have that information today, or is that something that you can come back with when you do come back?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott, yeah, we don't have that information at the ready. However, I will just note, you know, anecdotally working through the program, at least, you know, during COVID, not this most recent appropriation. There were a significant number of students actually that, you know, found their opportunity to exposure to healthcare careers, primarily nursing careers, end up choosing to go on, and were actually appreciative of the opportunity to kind of start, as a CNA, as the first building block. But that program is now overseen and administered by Minnesota State, the Health Force Center of Excellence. So we can either get that data from Minnesota State or maybe an opportunity to hear directly from them as well, because the work is pretty incredible. Yeah.
Assistant Commissioner Robinson.
And thank you, Chair Eric and Representative Scott. I would also note that it'll probably be a few years before we would see a pipeline specifically from the CNA into somebody having completed their nursing credential and being licensed to nurse, just because the coursework that they need to get into as a pre-nursing student and then to complete their nursing program, it would probably be, I think we're probably a couple of years before we would see, be able to sort of measure it back to the specific program.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that information. That totally makes sense. Just hoping that data is going to be kept, because I think it's important data for us to have. We need nurses in this state. Yeah, it's really an important piece of this equation in my mind. Thank you.
Representative Scott, and I think when Minn State does come, they can talk about that and also how it interplays with their workforce development scholarship, so that I think they said it was 46% of the scholarships are for medical training of some sort, and so we can probably tease that out when they come. And we will also have OHE back. We'll have Minn State here several days. We'll have University of Minnesota here several days. So I'm very excited to dive deep into all of these issues. So we have about 5 minutes left of the presentation. So I'm wondering, Commissioner Olson, would you like to continue, or do you want to, or I could open it up to more member questions? Which direction would you like to go, Commissioner Olson?
Yeah, Madam Chair, thanks for the opportunity to weigh in with about 5 minutes. I think it's a good natural break point here to return next Tuesday and just kind of open it up for questions here with the information presented already, if that's okay.
I think that's a great idea, Commissioner Olson. So any other questions of what's been presented so far? So Representative Duran.
Hi, thank you guys for coming. I really appreciate it. You guys enlightened me on a lot of stuff here. Me being new to the Higher Education Committee, I have a couple questions about the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership grants. How are those actually chosen? How are the individuals chosen, and how are those grants given out? Okay.
Who would like to take that? Okay, Ms. Oliver.
Thanks, Chair Rarick and Representative. Hi, nice to meet you for the first time. MNEEP is actually a legislatively named grant, and it's one organization. So the legislature named that entity for receiving that amount of money. So it's not a competitive grant. It's one entity, and it's set that they're going to receive the $45,000. Obviously, we have to do financial review, make sure everything checks out, but we enter into a contract with them with, like, there's, I think there's just brief language in the writer for what they're supposed to do, but they develop a work plan and a budget, and we have a contract with them to complete that work within the 2-year span, and their $90,000 that they get over the biennium. So, yes.
Representative Duran.
And this is open to everybody then?
Ms. Oliver.
Chair Rarick, this is not a competitive grant. MNEEP is one organization, which my understanding is you all will have them in front of you to explain what their organization does. So legislatively named grants are identified entities that the legislature has identified that they're already named, an organization or multiple organizations possibly, are already identified as getting a set amount of money from the legislature or the state. So we don't have to do a competition. So this entity, like College Possible, for example, you're going to give College Possible $500,000. So our agency enters into a contract with College Possible because they've been named, and that's how much money the state said that organization is getting that money. So we, College Possible used to get money through one of our competitive grants, like the Intervention for College Attendance program we have. So they used to have to apply through a competitive grant through that competition, and that's how they would normally get it. But then they became a legislatively named grant, so they automatically got money. That's what MNEEP is doing. MNEEP gets the money automatically through as a legislatively named grant.
Thank you, Ms. Oliver. I think Assistant Commissioner Robinson has more to add.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And just one thing to clarify: so those are not grants that are going directly to students. They're not part of they're not a financial aid grant. So they're going to the organization that's providing the list of services that is specified in the legislation. So it's not something that any student is getting a particular financial grant through that program. Yeah, just to clarify.
And Representative Bedell, I would say you're onto something, because I know Chair of the Fraud Prevention and Aid Agency Oversight Committee is going to ask a question, but we just had a fraud committee hearing, and the legislative auditor strongly advised the legislature to not do that sort of a grant unless they do incredible oversight on the front end. And I've been here 13 years, and I've never seen the level of oversight that we probably should be doing. So I'm going to turn it over for the last couple of minutes to Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually don't have a fraud or grant-related question, although I may down the road. I just wondered, is it possible for when you come back next week, could you provide the slides for us? Mm-hmm. I think it would just be helpful as we're going along to take notes in those slides and have something to keep to refer back to. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. Yes, I had the same question, and so we will look forward to if you would send them to our staff in advance, and we'll get them in everyone's folder. Okay, so we have a minute or two. Any questions on this side for Oki at this juncture? Otherwise, we will have them back. Okay, seeing none, we appreciate your time. Do you have any closing thoughts before we close up this part, and we'll have you back soon?
Madam Chair and members, no, not at this time, other than to say, you know, this was, I think, a good start and a preview, and next Tuesday, I think we'll get really exciting. We'll dive into all of our financial aid programs and other competitive grants, which I think we'll have plenty of opportunity for questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Olson. Yes, so there's, as we've talked offline and collaboratively before, the state grant is in trouble. And so I think if we do nothing else other than rescue the state grant program, we've done our due diligence this time around, because it's quite a big hole. So we will dive into that, talk about that, talk about options. And I realize that you've got some policy pieces that you've got to bring forward for that and recommend. And so I look forward to that conversation as well. And thank you one and all for coming today. I appreciate all your attention to all that detail. Thank you so much.
Okay.
So members, we have our first bill hearing, and as Ohi packs their things up, we've got Representative Isaacson that will be coming up, and excuse me, Representative Schultz, Isaac, I just call you Representative Isaac, Representative Schultz coming up, and you're going to be presenting House File 10. Do you have your testifier with you? She can certainly come up to the testifier table with you. So we'll be talking about House File 10, but I'm going to move House File 10 to be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. So the bill is now before us. Representative Schultz, and why don't you introduce yourself and continue with bill presentation of House File 10. Welcome to the committee.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. It's great to be with you. I am Representative Isaac Schultz. I represent House District 10B in central Minnesota, and honored to present House File 10 before you this afternoon with the sole purpose, members, of addressing our looming budget deficit in Minnesota with over $5 billion projected as a deficit in just a couple years. It's time for us to begin the conversation over some of the tough decisions that we're going to have to wrestle with. And so House File 10 is that first step to get us on a path towards fiscal responsibility and to reprioritize Minnesota's priorities with the people and the taxpayers and the citizens of America and the people of Minnesota. And so we've seen that for far too long there have been spending priorities placed in areas that, frankly, many Minnesotans don't support. And following the last election and looking at our budget outlook in Minnesota, it's important for us to take a look at the programs that are provided and see that in state policy today, currently, there are many people who are here in our state illegally receiving public benefits. And for the purposes of our discussion today, we're discussing the dollars that are spent in the area of higher education. And so Section 2 of this bill specifically addresses the tax dollars that are going to support people who are here illegally. And we, in this bill, will change the eligibility requirements around the North Star Promise Act. And while this is a relatively new program, still going through its first full academic year, we already know that over $86,000 of taxpayer dollars have gone to fund people who are here illegally. And it is my goal through this bill that we really take a look at the eligibility requirements for tax dollars as they are meant to benefit the people of Minnesota, the taxpayers of Minnesota, the citizens of our country, that we take a look at this, because our state policy today, not only through the North Star Promise Act, but through other priorities that the Office of Higher Education provides, has resulted in, just in 2023 alone, over $2.7 million going to support people who are here illegally. And so House File 10 will address those eligibility requirements and to ensure that we are helping make Minnesota more affordable. With this bill, hundreds of millions of dollars in years to come will be able to be protected for Minnesota taxpayers and American citizens. With that, I'm eager to hear the testimony. I ask for your support today, and also eager to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. So I think what you're referring to is, unfortunately, we don't have a fiscal note as we are so new in being fully duly organized. But a fiscal note has been requested a couple months ago. It is being put together, and in lieu of that, the Office of Higher Education, who is right behind you, did present some information to us, and you referenced one of those that was the total through the DREAM Act. So, and I think you mentioned this in your testimony, that already those that are here illegally cannot access any of the state grants or loan forgiveness or scholarship money through OHE, and only through the DREAM Act, which was enacted in 2013, can they access any of those funds. And and you had referenced specifically the Minnesota state grants that had been received in fiscal year 23 of $2.775 million. And if I misspeak, please, OHE, just raise your hand, because they are literally right behind you. So we don't have an official fiscal note, which, of course, I don't like to do, and I would rather not do it this way. So my promise to the committee members is that when the fiscal note is fully put together, I do have, like, the components of it here, and I will bring that bill back so that we can review the fiscal note. So I'm willing to move this forward to the next committee so we can also have that committee of jurisdiction conversation there. But a fiscal note has been requested. I have the fiscal components in front of me. OHE are the ones that provided it, and we can get this to all members as well. I don't know if you have that as part of your packet today, or any Representative Schultz. I don't know if you have the email from OHE that has all of the information that you're referencing, but if you had that for the committee, that would be great. If not, we'll get that out in an email to everybody so they have the exact same information that we're working off of, Representative Cleaborn.
Thank you. I'm just wondering how many committee stops this bill will make, because I'm looking at it and seeing 16A, which is management and budget, so it would need to go to state gov. We're in higher ed. You were referencing now that it's going to go to health next. Will it go also to judiciary?
Representative Cleaborn, I don't have the full path in front of me, but I will absolutely get that answer for you. So next time we meet, I'll have that answer for you.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. So Representative Schultz, I was just going to ask you if you had the email that came from OHE with all of the numbers you're referencing. I don't know if you have that for the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do not have printed copies, but I would be happy to share the information exactly as you stated from the Office of Higher Education with all the committee members.
Great.
That can be emailed to you.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. And so I would also note, too, and I would normally just ask OHE to come up, but I didn't do that in advance. We've just organized, and so this is our first committee, but in conversations I had with OHE offline, this is part of their application process. So they have to determine whether or not that person is eligible, and part of the eligibility is to determine if they're here legally or not. And the DREAM Act allows that path, and it's very confined. Would you like to speak briefly to the DREAM Act and that path into some of these awards and what you're going to be removing as an option through your bill? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, stating specifically what you'll find in the language in House File 10 is addressing the eligibility requirements of a resident student. And in state law, currently, you referenced, Madam Chair, correctly, that in 2013, the state statute is 135A.043, the resident tuition that essentially provides for people who are here illegally to gain access to government dollars, specifically in the area of higher education. And well within that statute, it specifically provides some flowery language that has allowed for the Office of Higher Education to spend these dollars. And through House File 10, we would be exempting that statute from the North Star Promise, and ultimately, with the other language included in Section 1 of this bill, would also address any other programs that currently are in law and allowed by the Office of Higher Education.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. So you did reference it. It's Chapter 135A.043. And just quickly, just for the record, you must have attended a Minnesota high school for 3 years or more and graduated from a Minnesota high school or attained a GED in Minnesota and complied with U.S. Selective Service requirements. So those are the top level three requirements in order to access the DREAM Act.
Correct, okay. Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Cleburne.
I'm so sorry. I feel like I'm working at a disadvantage here. You have data that we don't have. And so I'm like really confused as to what students we're really talking about. And if we could have OHI come up and explain to us who these students are.
Sure.
And maybe give us some factual information behind what we're talking. I'm so sorry. I just don't have the information that you're referencing.
Representative Cleburne, yep. So I'll ask the commissioner if he would like to come up. We are working from a document that he did send to us. And to be crystal clear, Representative Cleburne, pardon me? Oh, there should be a copy of the DREAM Act statutes in your packet. And as you're pulling that out, the DREAM Act was passed in 2013, and it is the only path that someone that is here illegally can access any of the state grant programs, scholarships, and also now the North Star Promise.
It's the word illegal that I'm pushing back on, because if they are here in the DREAM Act, they have protections afforded to them by the United States government. And that's why I'm a little confused as to the conversation.
Thank you, Representative Cleburne. So I will turn to Nonpartisan because they actually prepared some of this as well. Would you like to hear from OHI first, or would you like to hear from about the DREAM Act from Nonpartisan?
I would like to hear from OHI first about their statement about the students. I think that would be helpful to all of us. And then I guess Nonpartisan can answer the question that you would like to ask of Nonpartisan.
Okay. Well, thank you, Representative Cleburne. So I'm going to ask, but if you would be willing to, Chair Commissioner Olson, to come up, and if you'd like, I could. Do you have the email that you sent to us, or would you like me to hand it to you, Commissioner Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do not, unfortunately, have the email up in front of me, but just want to maybe outline some of the data that was requested of us and provided to the chair and members. So Representative Schultz noted, first of all, a dollar figure related to a North Star Promise. Thank you. So we had provided data for North Star Promise that as of January 15th, so we're looking back a little bit, our most recent available data, 145 students were eligible for North Star Promise funding applied through the DREAM Act. So 11 of the 145 were awarded North Star Promise base awards. That total was $23,299. There were 137 students that were awarded North Star Promise plus awards that totaled $63,100. And so the total in the aggregate, which was just reported, $86,399. And you'll notice that, you know, 137 and 11 don't add up to 145. It's because three students received both the North Star Promise Plus as well as the base award. So there are students that are eligible for both, depending on the calculation. So that's the one, or the $86,000 number that was reported. Regarding state grant data, that's actually data that I was going to present with our financial aid programs coming up next Tuesday. For fiscal year 23, there were 411 students that were awarded the Minnesota State Grant through the DREAM Act application. And just for a little bit of framing, I think it's included in the email, but not going to reference the email right now. 67,854 students overall received a state grant. 411 applied through the DREAM Act and were awarded. It's 0.6% of the total state grant recipients. That was fiscal 23. For fiscal 24, we had 71,530 overall recipients of the Minnesota State Grant. 506 students were awarded the state grant through the DREAM Act application. That's 0.7% of the total state grant recipients. And so that's the data that was provided to the committee at the time. And apologies, we didn't get to it today. It was planned for Tuesday during our overall state financial aid presentation.
Thank you, Commissioner Olson. I don't like to call you up unnecessarily, but it seemed that it was the only option. And so thank you for bracing us with that. I appreciate it. And Now you won't need to present it next Tuesday. So
it'll be there.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Okay. Do you, Representative Cleburne or others, do you have any other concerns about the, would you like to hear from nonpartisan as to what the DREAM Act is and how you access this grants and scholarships and what's our promise through the DREAM Act?
I think because there are so many new people to this committee, it would be very helpful. And to call people illegal is just not something that people are not illegal. They may be undocumented, but people are not illegal. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cleburne. I always try to say, unless I misspoke, the people that are here illegally, and I recognize that. I appreciate that. But so the question is, would you like to hear from not? Yes. Okay. So, Mr. Hopkins, would you like to explain the DREAM Act?
Madam Chair and members, so it might be useful to refer to the two statutes and member packets that were printed out. One of them is, the heading is definitions. It's section 136A.101. Subdivision 8 provides a number of criteria that a person can, that through which a person can become a resident student for purposes of state financial aid. There are 10 total. Number 9 is the one that cross-references what is colloquially known as the Minnesota DREAM Act. And that statute is also printed out in your packet. It's 135A.043. So this is the only criterion in that definition of a resident student that a person who is an undocumented immigrant living in Minnesota could use to become eligible for state financial aid.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. So we have so many people who want to testify. If what I'd like to do is go through the testimony and then we'll do more member discussion. Is it okay, Representative Hicks, really quick?
Thank you so much. Mr. Hopkins, I'm so sorry, but the residency, I looked at it. Would that also include people who are in process? For example, a young woman who was sexually trafficked and is here undocumented but has applied for special immigrant juvenile status because she's 14 years old and was sexually exploited. Would she qualify for the DREAM Act?
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Hicks, so you can qualify for the Minnesota DREAM Act if you look at the resident tuition statute there, the Minnesota DREAM Act statute, if you have high school attendance within the state for 3 or more years and have graduated from a state high school or attained your GED in Minnesota. And then item number 3 in that statute refers specifically to students without lawful immigration status.
So that would include people who
Representative Hicks.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chair. That would include people who have applied for legal status like those under SIJIS or asylum. Is that correct?
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representatives, so it just refers to a student without lawful immigration status. So if the student has applied through some sort of federal program and has some kind of recognized lawful immigration status, they would not need to worry about number 3 there.
Okay, so we're going to continue on so we can hear from students. So Representative Schultz, if you want to introduce your testifier, and then she can introduce herself, I suppose, too, and then have her testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Emma Jopp. Okay. I'm a 19-year-old college student from Malacca, Minnesota. I'm here to testify today in support of HF 10. I come before you as a student facing the challenges of the current economy and the growing burden of college debt. Many Minnesotans are struggling to make ends meet, and the cost of obtaining higher education continues to rise. I regularly engage in conversations with my fellow students and coworkers about these issues. One of my coworkers has regularly gone without food before payday, and I have friends who find it increasingly difficult to prioritize higher education and their future careers over the looming debt that will follow them into much of their adult life. Taxpayer funds are limited, and if we spread them too thin by offering aid to everyone, we risk falling short of the responsibility owed to the people of Minnesota. I know firsthand how the current proposed budget cuts, such as reductions in disability waivers and special education transportation funds, have directly impacted individuals with disabilities in our communities. How many more marginalized Minnesotans will continue to be overlooked if we prioritize unnecessary funding to those who are not yet citizens of this state? While I understand and appreciate the value of offering aid to as many people as possible, our primary duty should be to Minnesota citizens. Let us first focus on lifting our own out of poverty so that we can create a stronger and more prosperous state that is better positioned to help those in need. I urge you to keep the hardworking citizens of Minnesota in mind and vote in favor of HF 10. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jopp. We actually have four additional testifiers, and so in order, we'll have Sagrio Torres first. Great. And then after that, Ava Pena. If you want to come up together, that would be great. We'll start with these two. The next two after that are Danielle Haig and Samantha Diaz. Ms. Torres, please introduce yourself to the committee, and you have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for having me. My name is Sagrario Torres Flores. I am here to speak as a community member of Minneapolis, a general member of Comunidades Organizando el Poder y la Acción Latina, otherwise known as COPAL, and as a public university employee. At the university I work at, I am the point person for resources and support for our Latine, immigrant, and Spanish-speaking students. My day-to-day work includes meeting with students to talk through different career paths, map out graduation plans, and apply for financial aid opportunities. I have the privilege of holding space for students and the stories they share. My work has allowed me to see the direct impact the North Star Promise grant has had on the academic success of our students. Many of the students I engage with are the first in their families to attend college. Outside of school, these students are full-time employees, parents to young children, freelance workers, overnight workers, construction workers, and caretakers of siblings, nephews, and cousins. To the school, they are our future nurses, entrepreneurs, diplomats, public school educators, architects, and mechanical engineers. Those of us who were afforded the privilege of attending university may remember wearing many of these hats at the same time. The North Star Promise grant understands the demands of a college education and sees students as more than their aspirations. It sees them for all of the hats they wear, in and outside of school. It understands that for students to perform well inside the classroom, they have to be okay outside of the classroom.
Thank you, Ms. Torres. That's 2 minutes. I'll let you finish the last sentence, and then we'll go on to the next testifier.
Stripping the North Star Promise from any currently eligible students only serves to hurt the future we are trying to build. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Ms. Pena. Please introduce yourself to the committee and then continue with your testimony. You have 2 minutes.
Hi. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Eva Pena, and I am a COPAL member, a student at the University of Minnesota, and a North Star program beneficiary. And I'm here to defend the North Star Promise program because of all my peers that benefit from it. I know that if I were unable to receive the North Star Promise, I would not be able to afford college. And it is the same case for all my peers. My peers add so much to the classroom. They add different perspectives and ideas. My college experience would not be the same without them. Not only are they my student peers, they are my friends and my loved ones. These current recipients not only have been utilizing the promise to work towards a career, they have also fostered relationships in the classroom and on campus. They have made life-changing connections that will benefit their future career and have been a part of internships, all of which would have not been possible if they had not had the opportunity to attend college. This law is about protecting students who are already studying and working in Minnesota and making sure that they have the same pathways as everyone else. All Minnesota students deserve to have the same opportunity to seek higher education and pave a future for themselves. They are Minnesotans. Please reject any efforts to remove students from eligibility for the North Star Promise program. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pena. Okay, next up we have Danielle. I'm not sure how you say your last name, so come on up, and Samantha Diaz, if you want to come up. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Thank you for having me. My name is Danielle Huck, and I have been a professor of English at Minnesota State University Mankato for the past 11 years. I'm here today to strongly support the North Star Promise program for all of our students because it is a vital investment in our region and our state's future. The students who benefit from the North Star Promise sat in my classroom this past fall, putting in the hard work, developing critical skills, and approaching the world with curiosity and determination. These students come from rural communities, veteran backgrounds, and working families who would not otherwise be able to afford a college education. And the data is clear. College degrees lead to stronger communities, higher lifetime earnings, and greater civic engagement. Our graduates serve the public good, lifting up not only themselves, but also their families and the communities they return to. If we deny access to higher education, we are choosing a future where more Minnesotans face economic instability, rely on public assistance, and struggle to build a life in our state. We want social mobility, not a permanent underclass. My former students teach in high school classrooms from St. Peter to Moorhead. One is a science writer for the Marshfield Clinic. Another is a speech pathologist in our district. Many of them go on to graduate programs and they become RNs. More students deserve these opportunities, not fewer. Without access to this program, too many of your constituents would be shut out of the opportunity to pursue a degree. Enter high-demand careers and strengthen Minnesota's workforce and economy. The North Star Promise Program is not just an investment in citizens. It is an investment in the prosperity of our entire state. All of our kids deserve an education. We all benefit from it. I urge you to oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Diaz, you have 2 minutes. Introduce yourself to the committee.
Madam Chair and members, can you hear me?
We can
Madam
hear
Chair
you.
And members, my name is Samantha Diaz, and I'm the political director of SEIU Local 26, representing 8,000 janitor security officers, high-rise window cleaners, and airport passenger service workers, opposing the exclusion of our fellow Minnesotans in critical programs like the North Star Promise Act. I am also here today authorized to speak on behalf of Unite Here Local 17, 6,000 workers in our hospitality industry, and then UFCW 663, 15,000 workers representing retail, grocery, meatpacking, manufacturing, healthcare, and more. We understand what this hearing is actually about. It's about dividing us from and as a distraction from the real issues that keep our families up at night. Minnesotans are angry and feel the day-to-day impact of rising costs of student loans and just the cost of higher education. This is at the same time when billionaires and big corporations are allowed to hoard more and more money off of our backs. So instead of celebrating a policy that actually helps address this issue, this committee is choosing to roll back this law for a select targeted few Minnesotans. We have seen nationally that the goal of proposals like this is not to, it's not about better policy in order to help people, help high school students. It's to slash and burn good programs, often using our immigrant neighbors as scapegoats. Will denying our neighbors access to programs that they have earned lower higher ed costs for others? We know the answer is no. Choosing to be harsh as possible to immigrant families does nothing to address the skyrocketing cost of higher ed and the greedy loan companies who are making huge profits off of our families. And just to note, their greed doesn't take into account where we were born or what political party we are part of. And so as a state, we are better than this, and I hope this committee can rise above the divisive politics that Minnesotans absolutely hate. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Diaz. Thank you all for your testimony today. We really do appreciate it. So, members, I have like 3 minutes, and I do want to take a vote on this today. So I will, I think, lead Wolgamont, if that is okay, we'll go to you, and then I would like to take a vote.
Chair Rearick, we would request additional time to make sure that our members can get their questions in on this bill that is very broad and has a lot of jurisdiction. So could we have more than 2.5 minutes for our members to be able to make their voices heard on this legislation?
So thank you for the request. The problem is we have another committee that comes in here, and so I can't keep this committee room because we do have someone coming in 2 minutes to clear it and reestablish it for the next committee. I would have to check with leadership if we want to do something, you know, in the evening, come back in the evening. I can't bring it back on Thursday because we have a full agenda on Thursday. So my recommendation is, what I would also say is that we are, even though this is a big bill, the amount that's in higher ed is very, very small, as you heard. They were speaking specifically to the North Star Promise, which is less than $100,000. It's a very small amount. The bill is bigger, and it will go to other places as well. So I don't have the ability to put it, you know, to do it longer in here because we do have another committee right on top of us at 3:00.
Well, Chair Rearick, I appreciate your commitment to bring this bill back before the Higher Education Committee once we do have a fiscal note. Perhaps at that point we will have more time to be able to ask our questions and get our points in. So out of appreciation for the fact that you have committed to bring this bill back before the committee, I think we can ask our questions and make our voices heard at that point. Although I would like to ask, since we are sort of mapping out this bill at this point, if the author of the bill could tell me what that expected path is, what other committee stops it will have, that way we can make sure that we get it back here in our jurisdiction in higher education.
Sure. So, Representative Schultz, you happen to know the bill path, all of the committees it will be going through.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. The plan, I believe, is to go to Health next, State Gov, and then potentially a return to this committee at that time. Hopefully, we have more detail on the fiscal note. And this is also a work in progress. So if you have ways to make this bill better, we can work together on that. Thank you.
So with that, I would like to move to a vote because we do have to close committee. I'm already a couple of minutes over.
Madam Chair.
First of all, can I request a roll call?
Oh, of course. A roll call have been requested. A roll call will be granted. And so let me renew my motion, and then we'll go to the roll call.
Sorry, I wasn't quite finished. I trust your assurances, but we all know that sometimes assurances change as session moves forward. And I'm very concerned, not only, frankly, for our members' ability to ask questions, but for the public to hear and truly understand the effect that this bill would have. As an example, you've said that this only affects North Star Promise and State Grant. The way I read Section 1, it could be a lot more expansive than that. So I think maybe that's not the case. The point is we haven't had the opportunity to ask and answer those questions in a public forum. I would respectfully request that the proper approach would be to table this bill.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. I'm not going to table the bill because I will demand that it comes back here when the fiscal note is completed, and I would prefer to have that deeper dive once the fiscal note comes back. You can have plenty of time to come up with questions and concerns. I have them as well. Unfortunately, I have another committee coming in here in the next. They're already going to be walking in any minute, so I would like to go to a roll call, and then we will. And you certainly can vote no, and we once. Yeah.
Madam Chair.
1 second, please, Representative Knorr. We are discussing whether or not we can have another committee hearing tonight. So we will. Well, I have to check with leadership to see if there are rooms available and staff available and IT available and house media available, a room available, all those things. So I can't just promise a room tonight to continue the discussion. So I would like to move to a vote, so I'm going to renew my motion that House File 10 be.
Madam Chair, Representative Knorr had a question.
And I'm in the middle of bringing forward a motion because we do have to clear the room. We're already over. I renew my motion that House File 10 be recommended to be referred to the House, to a Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy, and you will take the roll. I mean, Legislative Assistant can take the roll. Aye.
Schwartz.
Say aye.
Aye.
Allen.
Aye.
Coulter.
No.
Duran.
Aye.
Hansen?
No.
Hicks?
Nope.
Cleborn?
No.
Liebling?
No.
Knorr?
Absolutely not.
Novotny?
Aye.
Robbins?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Okay, so with 7 ayes and 6 nays, the motion prevails. And we are adjourned.